An elite team of CIA operatives flies overseas, breaks into foreign embassies, and steals secret codes, all without leaving a trace. While that might sound like the plot line of a Hollywood film, former CIA officer Doug Grote conducted such missions until he questioned his superiors about sloppy procedures on one operation that almost cost him and his team their freedom or maybe their lives. The battle that ensued between Grote and the CIA led to charges of espionage and extortion and 4 years in prison. Doug Grote joins us now from member station WUOT in Knoxville. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And tell us a little bit about your team.
About the team, well, depending on what we're up against, we'd have different specialists comprised or added to the team to handle whatever we might run into.
And they would include, for instance?
For instance, somebody in electronics, safes and locks, or flaps and seals.
Flaps and seals?
Correct. Flaps and seals. Oh, sorry. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what was that for?
Flaps and seals was the opening and resealing of whatever you had in front of you, like an envelope.
And what was your specialty?
Well, when I first went into the shop, I learned flaps and seals, and I did most of that for quite a while. And then probably about mid-'80s, I got into supporting operations overseas where I ran communications or I would run surveillance. And then after that, I stepped up to actually running operations.
And how did you get into such an unusual line of work?
Well, it was a roundabout route, but during the first year of training, we would be visited at our training site by members of the CIA and different organizations, and they would give us a little briefing about what they did with the hope that we might want to join up with them. And when I got out of the training, I was supposed to go to Moscow. They took that away from me, so I turned around and went to the shop.
The shop. And what was the formal name of the shop?
Special Operations Division.
And this was set up separately? You weren't in Langley?
No, we were outside the Beltway, south of the Beltway.
And how many people were in this unit?
Probably 8 or 10.
And how many operations did you mount?
Well, according to what the agency put in the records was 60, about 60 operations.
And this is in a day when codes are so complicated, and sometimes they can be broken by the computers over at the NSA, but sometimes the easiest way to break them is to steal them.
Yes, that's true.
And what was, literally, you would drive up in the middle of the night when the embassy was closed, or can you describe a typical, if there was a typical operation, what happened?
Well, the typical operation, if you want to call it that, would be spending quite a bit of time out in the field, surveilling the area, watching people come and go, find out who's using the building, who's in and out, and then, find out where they go. And then taking pictures, checking communications, also training the station people, those are the CIA people in the field, how to assist on our operations.
And then the big night.
Then it's about a 10-page report explaining all the things that you're going to do and how you're going to do it and how the security is going to run and how safety of all the people and et cetera, were spelled out. Then it was time. What
was the best part of this job?
The best part of the job was the morning after. It's, it was exhilarating. I mean, you had just done something that, first of all, nobody's ever going to know you did it. Second of all, you defeated things that were supposedly undefeatable. And third is you're leaving the country and you had a great time.
Things that are supposedly undefeatable, these are the most sophisticated door locks, and then there are camera systems and special, lasers, I assume, that detect you if you're moving inside, all that sort of thing?
Well, back then we didn't run into any of those, but there were safes and locks and alarms and things like that had to be overcome.
And back then, what time are we talking about?
Back in the mid-'80s.
So there was then one mission that didn't go so well.
Yes, that's true.
Can you tell us what happened on that?
Well, as it explains in the Smithsonian article, I wasn't allowed to go out to the field. And the article says that it was because there wasn't enough money in the budget. But what I found out later is because the managers, who wouldn't allow me to go, were going to use that money to give themselves bonuses at the end of the year. So they short-circuited the operations, and you know I had to go out cold, and that was not the way to do it.
And so as opposed to driving up when the coast was clear, you drove up and got a signal from a source saying, hold on, don't go inside.
Exactly, and that we should have known about that. There was no way that that should have happened.
And what actually did happen was that a maid was in the embassy that you had targeted that was not expected to be there cleaning up and obviously in the way.
Well, part of the problem, too, was at one point my group chief said, you don't have to send any more questions to the field. You've asked enough questions. And those are the kind of things I would have asked and I had asked in the past.
Those kinds of questions that they said, never mind, we're all set this time.
Correct.
And it turned out those questions had not been asked and answered, at least not sufficiently.
We were hanging out to dry. I mean, it was terrible. We were sitting in a car in a non-white neighborhood, you know, six white faces. There's somebody sitting on my lap in the car because we didn't have a big enough car. And, you know, we're sweating and we're waiting for the go-ahead. And then when we get in, there was no perimeter security. There was nobody to tell us if somebody's walking through the door or anything. Yeah, it was bad.
And these are dangerous things to begin with, and obviously things can always go wrong, but if you don't do the advance work, clearly things can go wrong.
Well, when I ran an operation, first of all, the mission was the primary, but there were three heavy responsibilities within that mission. One was the safety of the team. If we got caught, I mean, especially depending on the target, you know, you're not going to be seen again probably, because you're in the target's country when you're in something like that, you know, in the embassy.
So if, for example, you broke into, I'm making this up out of whole cloth, the article in the Smithsonian does not identify the nations whose embassies you targeted, and I don't know anything about it. But say you broke into the embassy of, Romania. As soon as you're in the embassy, you're on Romanian soil.
Correct.
And so if they arrest you, you're going to get packed off back to Romania or maybe just disappeared.
Well, most of the time, the local chief of station had some kind of something in or set up that he could try to get us out of the situation if something happened like that. But technically, no, they don't. Nobody has to listen to the local laws because you're in their country.
And so did this job that, was not set up properly, did it go off all right in the end?
Luckily, yes. But two other things I want to mention, though, that there were not only the safety of the team, there was the reputation of the United States. I mean, if we got caught doing something or in somewhere we shouldn't be, that would have been an international flap between our country and whoever else and probably the country we're working in. And then the third and most important was the life of the agent. I mean, the CIA leans on agents almost, I mean, not exclusively, but, you know, a large percentage of the time to gather information. And this guy was very critical to their operations. And when I came back and complained about it, nobody cared.
There is one of the important things, and we'll get to the aftermath of that in just a second, but one of the important things is to make sure that there are no traces left behind. You mentioned flaps and seals. Things had to be opened and then resealed exactly the way they were. If you lifted a document out of a safe, it had to be placed in exactly the same spot it was before.
Exactly. Correct. Go ahead.
These are not easy things to do.
Well, that's where the patience and focus on what you're doing comes into play, and that's all you could do. You're hanging out there when something is open, of course, especially in the situation that was described. In other situations, maybe they were given to us and we'd work on them. But that was very important. And if you had to, you made notes, took pictures, you did whatever you could to make sure everything was in the same place that you started out.
And were you ever informed as to whether the codes that you received, were important, that they resulted in some important breakthrough or not?
Well, normally after an operation, we'd get word that there had been X amount of of intelligence reports written based on what we had found out. And that was just the tip of the iceberg because, you know, in a lot of places we found stuff that would, you know, last several months where they would be reporting, you know, day after day after day of intelligence information.
And did you ever run into something serendipitously, something lying on the ambassador's desk, for example?
No.
No. They're pretty careful, too.
Evidently. I mean, everything was tucked away.
We're talking with Douglas Grote, former Central Intelligence Agency agent. His story appears in the October issue of Smithsonian Magazine. You can find a link to that at our website at npr.org. He's with us today from member station WUOT in Knoxville, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So in the aftermath of this operation, which was in part botched, but eventually everybody got out all right, complaints and nobody wanted to listen to it.
Well, the problem is, I mean, the agency had had this organization for probably about 30 years, and there had never, ever been anything that close to screwing up. And, yeah, you're right. When I talked to the group chief and the office director, right on up to the executive director of the agency, and all they worried about was me confronting them.
And going outside the chain of command, as it were.
Well, actually, I went all the way up the chain of command one at a time. Yeah.
And so it was just that they say we've got this squeaky wheel down there and he's a problem.
That's it. That was it. Exactly.
And so you got essentially sidelined. You were sent to another job.
Yeah, I was released from the shop in October 91 and I sat with nothing to do till May of 93.
And what did you decide to do then?
Well, I decided to... May of 93, let's see. Well, we were negotiating from that point till 1997. I was negotiating with the Office of General Counsel, which was the legal side of the agency, and trying to resolve the whole issue.
The whole issue of your departure from the Central Intelligence Agency.
Correct. Plus, I filed a grievance, and that was being investigated, which I found out wasn't really being investigated.
But then there were other actions that you undertook to say, look, if the Central Intelligence Agency is not too interested in my skills anymore, maybe somebody else is.
Oh, that's further down. My first reaction was from 91 until September 92, I heard continuously, day after day after day, that what you did meant nothing. And finally, I said to somebody, I said, well, then maybe I should just cancel everything that I did if it meant nothing. And they thought I was joking. So finally in September 92, when I realized I wasn't getting my job back, I had found a job, somebody went behind my back and had me taken off the job within the agency. Mm-hmm. And so what I did is I wrote a letter to a foreign embassy and advised them that the equipment had been bugged.
You could understand how this might not be entirely square with the CIA.
Absolutely. But what I figured was, because I had trained several of the FBI officers in flaps and seals, and I had also gone on operations with them, I knew a little bit about what they did within the country, and I didn't even figure that we'd get out of the country, the letters.
Did they? Did you get any response at all?
Well, the only thing that the FBI talked to me, they said that they had picked it up from some foreign intelligence service that had passed it to them. But when I was debriefed in 1998 by NSA, the lady who debriefed me was asking questions, and we talked about the letters, and she said, don't you realize how much those letters could have hurt NSA? So I don't think they got out.
But she's right. They could have hurt.
Sure, sure.
And was that the point?
No, the point wasn't to hurt anything. I mean, well, first of all, I picked an operation that I knew no agent was involved, so it wouldn't hurt anything, or wouldn't hurt them. But at the same time, I didn't expect them to get out.
Then there is the issue of offering your services elsewhere.
That was in 1997. What happened was, is the agency sent me an offer for a contract, and the contract said, you know, that they would give me $300,000 over 6 years, and then I would drop down to another grade and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But what nobody knows is the contract, and I'll read it to you. Failure to comply fully with the above would, at the discretion of the agency, be considered a breach of this agreement. Under such circumstances, the agency would have the option of terminating the contract. When I saw that, I said, they're not telling me the truth, and they're not going to back it.
Long story short, because we're running out of time, you were called in for what you thought was a negotiation and put under arrest.
Correct.
And put in, you say, isolation for 6 months.
For 6 months with the lights on 24 hours. One time I woke up, they said, what time is it? Because I was going to ask for some breakfast, and they said, it's 4 o'clock. I said, well, I'm going back to bed. Then they said, no, it's 4 p.m. I didn't even know what day it was, what time it was, or anything.
And eventually, it became criminal charges.
That's what they filed, yes.
And you would end up spending 4 years of a 5-year sentence in prison.
Correct.
And I wonder, after all of this, are you bitter?
No. I mean, I spent my 4 years doing a lot of reading. I always wanted to read about philosophy, and I've found a peace in myself. And I hope everybody else that was involved can find the same thing.
And quickly, do you think the CIA continues to do these sorts of things? Is the shop still in business?
No doubt. If they've been doing it for 30 years before I was there, I'm sure they're still doing it. I mean, it's very important. It's very important.
Doug Grote, thanks very much for your time today.
Well, you're welcome.
Doug Grote was a CIA officer. Again, his story appears in the October issue of Smithsonian Magazine. You can find the link to that at our website at npr.org. He joined us today from member station WUOT in Knoxville. Tomorrow, growing concerns over putting children with disabilities into nursing homes. Join us for that conversation. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.